Penguin Random House Audio presents To the End of the Earth, The U.S. Army and the Downfall of Japan, 1945, by John C. McManus, read for you by Walter Dixon. 1. Crusade. Like a faithful steed, USS Boise plunged through the deep blue waters of the South China Sea, the ship's prow knifing gracefully through the relentless waves, bound for Luzon. Below deck, inside a snug, well-appointed private cabin, General Douglas MacArthur sat at a desk, pen in hand, preparing to write a letter to his wife on January 8, 1945, the eve of the largest invasion to date in the war against Japan. At once a magisterial and vexing figure, MacArthur oozed a sense of captivating uniqueness. He was the only U.S. Army field commander who had once served at the very top of the Army as chief of staff. Only he, among all the Army ground generals in the Pacific, had been decorated with the Medal of Honor, a distinction he shared with his late father, Lieutenant General Arthur MacArthur, who had, 4 decades earlier, led American military forces in the Philippines. During World War II, Douglas MacArthur had experienced, by far, more frontline combat than any other American general of 4-star rank, only adding to a record of valor that he had already carved out as a younger officer in the First World War. In 1929, he had endured a difficult, stormy divorce from his first wife, Louise Cromwell, putting the lie to Army conventional wisdom that a failed marriage for an officer would inevitably lead to a failed career. 8 years later, he married Jean Faircloth, daughter of a Nashville banker and his true soulmate, who bore him a son named Arthur the next year. Astonishingly, MacArthur subsequently chose, in direct defiance of a War Department order to evacuate military families, to keep them with him in 1941 to 42, when he led the ill-fated Allied defense of the Philippines. He thus became the only high-level American commander to expose his family to combat in World War II. With unrepentant independence, he continued to live with his family throughout much of the war, seemingly indifferent to the fact that his many thousands of subordinates enjoyed no such option. In yet another characteristic action that revealed much about his broke-the-mold distinctiveness, he had willfully crossed the red line that sensibly separates the civil and the military in the American system by running an unsuccessful clandestine campaign to win the presidency in 1944. Complex to the point of near convolution, an intimate aide once said of the general, "None of us knew MacArthur. We all saw fragments of the man." Over 3 long years of war, he had carved out a record as a thoughtful military strategist, an innovator with a strong grasp of the potency of air power and sea power, and an inspirational figure whose keen understanding of image approached the savant level. But far too often, he had also revealed himself to be a petty, paranoid, insecure, vainglorious, egomaniacal schemer who seemingly viewed Washington policymakers as adversaries on par with the Japanese. An ardent opponent of the Allies' Europe-first policy, he believed with an almost evangelical fervor that America's geopolitical future lay in Asia and the Pacific. His greatest objective, perhaps as much as or more than defeating Japan, was to liberate the Philippines. His invasion of Leyte a couple months earlier had served only as a warm-up act for what he envisioned as an archipelago-wide liberation, most notably of Luzon, his former home, with himself playing an almost predestined messianic role. Lieutenant Colonel Weldon Dusty Rhodes, his personal pilot and a close intimate, once opined of his chief that he had some feeling that he was a man of destiny. He seemed to believe that he was especially protected so that he could fulfill a mission. MacArthur loved the people of the Philippines with almost familial intensity. In his mind, the impending invasion of Luzon equated to something of a 20th-century crusade. Only a few weeks shy of his 65th birthday, MacArthur remained physically robust, though he now combed strands of black hair over his balding pate in an apparent effort to conceal the encroachment of senior citizenship. He seldom allowed photographs of himself bareheaded, preferring instead to wear a specially designed braided cap most everywhere he went. Upscale sunglasses and a corncob pipe completed a look that seemingly only he could pull off. Hunched over the desk inside his cabin aboard Boise, MacArthur scrawled his letter to Jean on personal stationery. "The Boise is the most comfortable cruiser on which I have traveled. The suite I occupy is much larger, has artificial ventilation, and better cooking than the others." Battle-hardened Boise's modernity reflected the stupendous and growing power of the U.S. Navy by 1945. By the same token, MacArthur and his Southwest Pacific Area, SWPA, command could be said to symbolize the corresponding maturation of the U.S. Army during the war with Japan. He had once led a poorly equipped, sparsely fed colonial-style army in the Philippines, but now presided over the largest ground force ever assembled for amphibious island warfare. And these legions were only one component of a larger army that had now grown to full maturity. Indeed, nearly 1.4 million soldiers were now serving throughout the Pacific and Asia. By war's end, the number would swell to 1.8 million, the third largest ground force ever sent overseas by the United States to fight a war. Superbly equipped, highly mechanized, well-fed and well-led, the Army of the Pacific Asia Theater reflected the bounty of the nation that produced it, and it was shouldering the onerous responsibility of expeditionary-style warfare in far-flung, inhospitable locales. Army soldiers were doing the lion's share of the fighting and dying in the Pacific, particularly in the Philippines, the true nexus of the American war against Japan. And yet, contemporary and subsequent popular memory tended to focus on the more publicity-savvy and extraordinarily valorous Marines, who had carved out a distinguished combat record, but were far fewer in number than the soldiers. Even now, in 1945's infancy, the Army labored in an almost unbelievable diversity of missions, combat and non-combat, that included ostensibly everything from the logistics of loading and shipping to guerrilla warfare, from diplomacy to cutting-edge medical care, and from civil affairs to engineering of such sophistication as to lay foundations of knowledge to benefit future generations. Spread over nearly one-third of the globe's surface of island, sea, and continent, it was an army of such size and diversity of purpose as to make one unified command nearly impossible. MacArthur controlled only about 60% of Army combat formations. Over 3 years, the Army had steadily fought its way northward from the South Pacific to the Central Pacific and now beyond. The Army's evolution into an extraordinarily potent modern military force paralleled the maturation of the U.S. Navy into the most powerful maritime force in global history, a behemoth of sea power upon which rested the foundation of the American war against Japan. The Army Air Forces, particularly the B-29 formations that were beginning to bomb Japan itself, only added to this prodigious combination of American military strength that, in tandem with America's theater allies, now amounted to a dagger at the Japanese throat. Allied victory now seemed certain, and yet the tasks ahead, especially for the U.S. Army, were daunting in the extreme. The impending liberation of the Philippines, the opening of a viable landward supply route to China, and the seizure of key islands on the doorstep of Japan all loomed as costly enterprises on the immediate drawing board. And somewhere beyond, like an Everest on the horizon, a horrendously bloody invasion of Japan beckoned as a serious possibility, perhaps even a necessity. So the essential question now was how much it would cost the Allies, and most notably the Army, in lives, treasure, and time, to subdue Japan, a country still tightly controlled by a defiant cabal of civil and military elites who were loyally supported by millions of soldiers, sailors, and even ordinary citizens, most of whom seemed more than willing to fight on indefinitely, unto the death. The first answers to this disquieting question would now come at Luzon, the target of an enormous American task force, of which USS Boise was only one relatively small component. For nearly 40 miles in any direction around Boise, the huge invasion armada of some 700 ships carried or escorted 203,000 soldiers from all over General MacArthur's enormous SWPA empire. About one-third of these men were non-combat service troops. The soldiers hailed from a geographically diverse network of bases, ranging from Leyte to the picked-over South Pacific burgs of Noumea, Sansipor, Aitape, Finchofim Toom, Hollandia, Oro Bay, Noam Fort, Cape Gloucester, and Bougainville. Places
Sample complete. Ready to continue?